state of Idaho is now in session pursuant to law.
Thank you all. Please be seated once again. We are happy to be with you this morning for our second case here at the University of Idaho College of Law in Moscow. You'll note that Justice Colleen Zahn is recused in this case and is not sitting with the court. We therefore have Judge Rich Christensen from Coeur d'Alene who is sitting pro tem and will participate fully in this matter. This case is Dickinson v. Benoit County Sheriff, brought on appeal by Rodney Dickinson, who is represented here by Douglas A. Pierce. The Benoit County Sheriff and Benoit County are represented by Jennifer Fager. Good morning to counsel. Do either of you have any preliminary matters before argument today?
Will, Your Honor.
Very well, then. Mr. Pierce, you may proceed, sir.
Thank you, Justice. Good morning, Your Honors. I would like to take about 10 seconds of my time and apologize to Ms. Fager. In my arguments and my briefing to the court, I did not put her in there, only Mr. Peter Flint. So, to her, I apologize. It was not intentional anyway. Your Honors, the matter before the court this morning is a whistleblower case in accordance with the Idaho statutes, specifically nicknamed as the whistleblower statutes. That statute is clear, and the intent of the legislature in that statute is also clear. When an entity of the state of Idaho is doing something that is improper, illegal, or costing the state money, employees have not only the right, but I would argue the duty to present those mistakes, those problems, through the chain of command. This case before the court this morning is a quintessential exemplar case of what the legislature intended the Idaho whistleblower statute to be and do. An honest cop trying to protect the department from dishonest and unethical cops from doing illegal and unconstitutional acts. An honest cop tried through his authority, through writing up officers, writing up deputies, calling them on the carpet, and that early stage, they retaliated by saying, "You're picking on us." They even switched in an entire shift from his shift to a different shift, the day shift, because he was
Is the whistleblower statute meant to apply to a supervisor making bad reports to his subordinates, or is it more intended for a subordinate to be making complaints about his supervisors?
It's intended that, thank you, Justice Marr, that's a very fair question. It's intended that the state of Idaho is protected from the wrongdoings of the agencies, the employees of those agencies. So, in this case, Sergeant Dickinson, at the time Sergeant Dickinson, was trying to show to first the subordinates, trying to train them, and then when that said, I need a meeting with the sheriff. So, to answer your question, it's to protect both. It's to protect the state of Idaho. And that's why it's very narrow, if it's true, to the state of Idaho and its agencies.
It would just seem to me that a typical whistleblower case under the circumstances here would be that he'd be blowing the whistle against the undersheriff or the sheriff, not that he's blowing a whistle against his subordinates and then surreptitiously taping his superiors.
Well, what he was trying to do, in effect, on May 3rd, was blow the whistle on the undersheriff by saying to the sheriff, I'm trying to work with this. Now the undersheriff, my boss, isn't doing anything. In fact, from a perspective, he's even endorsing it and condoning it. So he was whistleblowing the undersheriff to the sheriff.
On May the 3rd, 2019.
That's the day that he recorded.
And what is in the record to show that Dickinson did more than try to tell the undersheriff what was going wrong in the department?
My client's affidavit where he says that he had numerous conversations with the undersheriff and to hopefully answer your question, Justice Edgar, in a bootstrapping manner, the policy that the sheriff would not deal with personnel issues was in effect last year.
I'm looking at Mr. Dickinson's affidavit, paragraph 7, says, I tried to report to the sheriff, but there's an emphasis on the word tried, and I don't know that there is a recounting of what was said by him to whom that would give rise to a whistleblower.
In paragraph 7.
But we have an example regarding the problems that I tried to report to the sheriff. I tried to do these.
Yes.
So you have to do more than try. You have to make complaints about public employees.
Justice Sager, my answer to that is his attempt was thwarted by the policy of the sheriff doesn't deal with personnel issues.
So is that a whistleblower complaint or is that a complaint about the process that was available to him?
His whistleblower complaint is from when he called the meeting after dealing with the undersheriff and now attempting to bring to the sheriff the issues.
Of course, the sheriff had recently had a stroke. How much was he involved in the day-to-day operations at that time?
Your Honor, Justice Miller, that would be a question for the jury.
What does the record show?
The record shows that he simply said, I'm not going to deal with personnel issues. And when you take a department of, we'll estimate, 15 people, that means that he wasn't that involved.
So this is really between Undersheriff Ellis and your client, then, from your perspective?
It is my client trying to work with the Undersheriff Ellis, not successfully doing so, and then having to report it to the sheriff and getting fired for that.
Well, that wasn't the stated reason for the discharge, though, was it? That he tried to report it. In fairness, there was another specific reason, wasn't there?
That he was fired?
Yeah.
He was fired for trying to record the reporter.
Exactly.
And then lying about it, which would create a Brady problem for the county.
And that is disputed that he lied about it. Unless it's decided that when he held up something and said, not with this, then I mean, it's not in the record where my client said, I'm not recording this, or when asked, did you record it, he said no, when in fact he did. That is not in the record.
Would you concede it was a lie of omission?
No. No. As was, if my client had If the sheriff had not had a stroke, the sheriff would have said, then what are you recording me with? That's my, always been my client's position in that very brief encounter.
I'm not sure I understand that statement.
The sheriff's stroke had, as evidenced by his desire to no longer deal with personnel issues, had, he wasn't hitting on all these cylinders like he had been.
So if the sheriff hadn't had a stroke, he probably would have figured out that the guy was making a lie of omission. Is that what you're saying?
I'm saying that if the sheriff hadn't had a stroke, then he would have dealt with the personnel issues. And without conceding that it was a lie of omission, by answering the question, are you recording me now, not with this, I would dispute that that's a lie of omission. If it had been a lie of omission, he would have said, well, I'm not recording with anything here. He simply said, not with this.
Well, if it's not the truth, it's certainly not the whole truth and nothing but the truth, is it?
Fair enough, Justice, but my client wasn't under oath. He was trying to report malfeasance and unconstitutional activities by deputies.
But how does recording with his car parked outside, how does that lead to the reporting of malfeasance?
When the time, if the time were to come to turn over to the Attorney General's office or the County Commissioners, then instead of the reply of the department being, well, he picks on the young kids, and he's just generally mean, say, I tried to report it. This was the response.
Well, that doesn't, in fairness, and pardon the expression, that doesn't sound like whistleblowing. That sounds like CYA.
Which is what the sheriff had instructed him to do on other occasions.
But you can't take CYA and turn that into whistleblowing, can you?
You can take the fact that you were fired for trying to do CYA as a whistleblower. Absolutely not.
Is it his contention he was engaged in protected activity by recording the conversation or some other activity he was engaged in that was a protected activity on each step?
The protected activity was twofold, and thank you for that question, Chief Justice. When my client recorded that, there was a level of CYA, but it was also to document his efforts and to move forward with that documentation, either to a different agency or coming back down to the sheriff's assistance. He certainly would have had it in his back pocket.
But he was aware of the policy of no recording, right?
Absolutely. And to that.
And so is the recording this protected activity?
The protected activity is recording. And I would say, I would argue that the recording of the recording is also protected. And I would bootstrap off of your question, Justice Pro Tem Christensen, that 6104, subsection 4, it says state agency cannot create policies that inhibit or prohibit, and I'm not quoting directly, but can implement policies that throw curveballs at an employee's ability to report. And
well, let me help you. It actually says unreasonably restrict or an employee's ability to document the existence. So are you saying this would be an infringement on the ability to document the existence of waste or other violation of laws and rules and regulations?
Yes. Precisely. And as doing so, it makes it a double protected activity. The reporting to the sheriff and the attempt to record that reporting, both are protected activities.
Well, if that's the case, and this is just your classic wrongful discharge case and not a whistleblower case, isn't it?
It's something that brought up the state agency and my client trying to protect the state of Idaho by bringing it up the chain of command. If this was not a state agency,
Did the prosecutor, though, based on what his view of this whole situation was, feel he had a Brady problem with ongoing prosecutions in the county? And irrespective of what we may all feel about what that was, did he then feel he had an obligation to issue notification on this officer's cases that he lied to his superiors about whether he was recording them? And isn't that a question when we're protecting the state of Idaho about also protecting the validity of the cases brought in that county by these officers?
There was, it's not clear in the record, but there was issues of cases having to be dismissed because of the improper conduct bordering on unconstitutional or even illegal of these deputies. And the prosecutor was, I think it's fair to say, as in the previous case, things in small towns, everybody knows each other. And so there was arguably some protection going on by the prosecutor of trying to train and re-educate, so to speak. That's not clear in the record, but I think in answer to your question, it's there to bring that in.
Well, but going back to subsection 4 of the statute, I mean, it's one thing not to allow the employer to implement a policy that's going to inhibit the employee's ability to document, but then when the employee is directly confronted about the recording and lies, I mean, that's not, the lie isn't a protected activity, is it?
Well, again, Justice Brody, I would argue that it wasn't a lie. It was I'm not recording you with this. But Sheriff, we need to get down to the brass tacks to get what we're talking about. And in order to avoid dealing with the problems in the department, the sheriff chose to say, now you're lying. Now, he was not fired for lying. So the department backed off on that to some extent. When asked, are you recording me? Not with this. My client was trying to get back to reporting the issues and bringing it to the sheriff's attention.
So help me understand what he was fired for then exactly. I guess I don't understand that.
Violating the policy of Sarah's, a secretly recording fellow officers and the sheriff. That was why he was terminated.
If an employer has no ability to restrict some information, I'm just wondering if that's a practical result here. For example, let's say your client had gone into the personnel files of some of these officers he was complaining about and had made photocopies of the content of their personal records to document issues. Under your view, would that be okay?
If my client had it in the chain of command, so to speak, that was within his realm of authority, yes. I would suspect.
It feels kind of like the end is justifying the mean here, which concerns me.
I would argue that that is exactly what 6.1, subsection 4 is for. Is for employees to say, this is you know, mine. This is a wrong policy. I need to circumvent it or just take it head on and deal with this policy. That's the power of the whistleblower statute. That's the need to protect the state of Idaho and their entities.
So under subsection 4, then, any kind of confidentiality policies that any agency has are essentially able to be overridden if an individual employee thinks the ends justifies the means?
That would be up to the jury to decide.
Is that a question of law or a question of fact?
It would be up to the jury to decide whether the fact pattern meets that statute. My client was denied that.
So we're going to have juries deciding then what our state policy is about confidential records?
We're going to have juries applying facts to a well-crafted jury instruction about what the law says. That's one way that my client was denied under Rule 56 is in record trial. That was a question arguably for the jury to ask, or to be asked. These are the facts as presented by each party. This is the statute. Is what former Sergeant Dickinson did, qualifying for this statute or did go too far. And that would be arguably for the lawyers to try and convince the 9, 10, 11, 12 jurors.
As a practical matter, setting aside the policy, if you have an employee that's surreptitiously recording conversations among other employees and their superiors, do you think that there's any reason why they'd be able to work effectively in that environment in the future?
Well, that's a question regarding looking in the windshield instead of the rearview mirror. And
well, as an appellate court, we do tend to look forward.
Fair enough, Your Honor. What the policy is there for is to protect the state of Iowa. There is fallout for, and the statute allows judges to reinstate. Would that be the proper course of action if a jury were to find that the violation of the policy was justified? And justifying means words right there. And so, yes, then it would be, yes, it would certainly be difficult to work, to go back and work in those conditions. But again, that's a fact-specific question, and it would, in that case, it would be up to the judge to decide how are we going to resolve this case. One would hope that the whistleblower statute would have taken the next step, and the personnel, the employees of the state, would be the solution would be to just fire them instead of firing the whistleblower. And then the answer to your question would be the problem is gone. And that's what the statute's for, is to make the problems go away. I believe my time is up at this point.
You are into your rebuttal by about a minute and a half.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning to Justice of the Court. May it please the Court of Counsel. Mr. Dickinson carried the burden of proof in this case. And in order to carry that burden, he has to show by the preponderance of the evidence that he suffered an adverse employment action because he engaged in a protected activity. To prove he was held for discharge, he has to prove three things. One, that he engaged in a protected activity. Two, that he suffered an adverse employment action. And three, the existence of a causal connection between the adverse employment action and the protected activity. And to me, the first element of the statute, Mr. Dickinson has to show that he was engaged in a protected activity. Iowa Code 6.104 states in relevant parts that an employer cannot take adverse action against an employee who communicates in good faith a violation of suspected violation of law. The statute requires that the employee communicates the suspected violation of the law. And the statute defines communicate as a written or verbal report. And this court held in Curley v. Kootenai County Fire Rescue 148-50391, communicate indicates that action is required on the part of the plaintiff. And just as Sidner kind of made my argument for me, it's important to note in the pleadings filed by Mr. Dickinson, in his affidavit, in his complaint, he never claimed that he actually communicated a violation or suspected violation of law.
I have a question. And it's just been bothering me. Is why is the report not in the record at all? Nobody puts it in the record in front of Judge Dunn.
Correct.
Can shed any light on you? We don't know what actually took place at this hearing that everybody agrees was recorded.
The recording, I would submit, wasn't put in the record for two reasons. First, the recording requires certain
disagree. Wouldn't the relevant part of the recording also include the allegations that the appellant allegedly made to the sheriff and the undersheriff?
It would, if the recording actually evidenced that. And that was my second point, is that Mr. Dixon carried the burden of proof in this case and did submit the recording because he couldn't evidence what he suggested evidence. And now he's using that as an effort to say there are questions of material fact as to what happened at that meeting because he didn't submit the recording evidence. And so the recording itself...
As far as the inferences we can draw from that, and I can understand why that's what you infer. I appreciate that. But couldn't we just as likely infer that you didn't submit it because there was something on there you didn't want us to hear?
You could infer that. That would be a reasonable answer. But... It's Mr. Dixon's burden of proof in this case.
Well, I thought his affidavit didn't even address directly what statements he made in the meeting either, or what he didn't put it in any form.
Correct. And Mr. Dixon's affidavit, in his deposition testimony, and in his complaint, he then alleged that he reported to the sheriff unconstitutional acts of either the deputies or acts that would be in violation of law with regard to the undersheriff. He attempted to report. He tried to report to the sheriff, but he just didn't get there.
So, Ms. Fager, that causes me to ask you about 6-2105, which states, to prevail on an action brought under the authority of this section, the employee shall establish by a preponderance of the evidence that the employee has suffered an adverse employment action because the employee or a person acting on his behalf engaged or intended to engage in an activity protected under Section 62104. You just used the word intended. The statute uses the word intended. How do we reconcile the statutes that say you have to communicate and another statute that says you're intended to communicate?
The intention to communicate has to be supported by some sort of evidence that the plaintiff took action, assembled information, or gathered the information to report the suspicion of violations of law. We don't have that in this case. I point the court to the court.
You just described as what he did was intended. And the statute says if you intended to do this, and I'm trying to understand how do we disregard intended in the statute?
By looking at what the plaintiff did to show that his actions were moving him forward with his intention.
The affidavit of Mr. Dickinson that we quoted earlier in paragraph 7 says, I tried to report to the sheriff about these things. But the fact that he testified in his affidavit that he tried, not show an intent?
Well, the statute also requires a communication, a verbal or written report. And I would say that an attempt is not a communication. And even if he attempted to do that, an attempt usually is something that is, there's an effort taken, but it's unsuccessful. And he was unsuccessful in this case.
But just because something's unsuccessful doesn't mean it was unintended. I mean, if he wanted to go to the report, if he wanted to make this report to the undersheriff and the sheriff and tried to talk about it, and they didn't want to talk about it, is that enough to show intent?
Based on the allegations alone, no. Under the statute, it requires that he does something to further that intention. He has to show that he was attempting, or that he recorded or communicated the suspected violation of law.
So, we're just focusing on the recorded incident, though. Isn't the appellant going to argue that over the years he had made complaints about these guys and they'd gone unignored? The recorded incidents was just the apex of everything came together at that moment. That's just one incident in time. There were other incidents, though, over the years that wouldn't they have evidence showing that there were reports made that were disregarded?
Well, and that's the key there, Your Honor, is that there isn't evidence that he tried to do that in the past. He states that in his affidavit. I attempted for several years to talk to the undersheriff, and I was ignored. Well, what did he talk to the undersheriff about? There's no evidence as to what was discussed. Who did he talk about? The complaints that were written down and given to the sheriff 2 months after his suspension and termination outlined specific activities. to defend the sheriff or the sheriff. His affidavit also states that he attempted or tried for 6 months to talk to the sheriff about his suspected violations of law, but we have no evidence of those attempts, those trials.
So this was decided not on a motion to dismiss, but on summary judgment. So we're not looking at the facial claims and saying they're inadequate. You're saying this was a failure of proof on summary judgment to show an undisputed issue of material fact.
Correct. And where the plaintiff doesn't present enough evidence to show a prima
facie
case under the whistleblower statute, there are no questions
of
fact. And
summary
dismissal is appropriate.
I'm looking at the transcript of the discussion at the 6-26-2019 hearing, which was the statement by Mr. Dickinson to Sheriff Reeser, or Resser, in which he outlined violations of sheriff employees, deputies in question. He goes through Deputy Brandon Vaniger. He goes through Deputy Dustin Pulley. He goes through Deputy Colton Wynn. Are those not facts that have been raised by Mr. Dickinson in contradiction to the argument that he didn't make any complaints about these individuals?
He didn't submit those complaints to the sheriff until his pre-termination hearing, which was 2 months after the county took the adverse employment action.
But one of the inferences we can draw is that these were the communications that Dickinson made with Ells. And if he's rebuffed in his efforts to get this information to the sheriff, isn't that sufficient to overcome some judgment?
Not if he hasn't submitted evidence to those efforts prior to his termination.
He was placed on administrative leave back in May, correct? He's placed on administrative leave on May 9th.
Correct.
After the recording incident. And he's placed on administrative leave for his surreptitious recording, correct?
Correct.
And then he doesn't present those statements until June 26th. He's not really terminated for cause until August 28th, right? I mean, he's in this no man's land, right?
Correct.
Is there an adverse action prior to the termination for cause on August 28th?
I would submit that the adverse action prior to his termination was his suspension of duty on command.
And that was sufficient under the statute?
Correct. And so his recording on June 26th at his pre-termination hearing was a post hoc attempt to save his job. He knew that he was suspended. He was given a notice of termination, and he was given the right to appeal that or for an inquiry.
But aren't you inferring that it was a post hoc attempt to save his job? Isn't that a question of fact that the jury should consider?
It's a post hoc attempt to save his job when he doesn't submit those complaints to the sheriff until after they've already taken adverse action. The adverse action had already taken place and he was suspended from his duty. And he was given notice. We're going to terminate your employment. You have a chance at a pre-termination hearing to clear your name. And that's when he got for the written documentation. That's the first time he verbally reported those 9 issues of the other deputies to the sheriff.
But that belies the statement that he gives. He says, I have reported these actions to the undersheriff, and he has ignored them completely or downplayed them with my, quote, picking on them, close quote, comments. It doesn't look like post hoc to me.
So the assertion that he made that he hasn't submitted any evidence to support. So I'll point the court to...
But we're at summary judgment. If this were a trial and the jury said, we don't believe that, that's a post hoc rationalization, that's one thing. That's quite another to draw an inference that these are uncontradicted. There's nothing in there, as far as I'm concerned, there's nothing in the declaration of Resser or Ells that says these conversations did not occur.
Sheriff Resser did testify in his declaration that he had not heard of the issues that were brought forward on the June 26th hearing prior to that hearing.
But that supports Dickinson's claim that the undersheriff was not providing those statements to the sheriff.
We don't have evidence as to what his complaints were to the undersheriff.
Well, but Dickinson, June 26th, outlined in some detail, I'm not going to go through all of them, but I'll just pick one at random. He was told about a certain deputy who went to a house on a domestic violence call, was unable to locate the defendant, went back a day later, was unable to locate him. He searched the residence, located vehicles, and slashed tires on the vehicles, seized all the firearms in the residence. He did this without the permission of the sheriff, and there was no search or arrest warrant issued. I mean, that's a pretty concerning thing that I have a hard time believing wasn't communicated to anyone, and he just suddenly made that up.
Well, if the court is going to look at the communication with regard to the protected activity in this case, we have to look at what he did with the recording. The recording, Mr. Dickinson is arguing that the recording was a way of communicating or a way of reporting. And that's not the purpose of what his recording was, and he states that in his deposition. He states that the purpose of the recording was to verify his attempt to report. He never said that he was recording because he was reporting. And I think that's an important distinction. We can't allow employees the protections of the whistleblower statute for their attempt to do something that never came into fruition.
So if a deputy, let's say there was a female deputy and she went to her supervisor and complained about sexual harassment, and she tried to go to the sheriff, the sheriff's like, I don't want to hear it. Would she have a whistleblower claim, or because she tried and failed, we would say it didn't go far enough?
If she had communicated to the undersheriff her concerns, and those concerns were documented, then yes, she would have a whistleblower.
Who creates those documents, though? If the sheriff refused to document it, then we would only have her word, wouldn't we?
Well, if we look at the case of Crowley versus Cleveland County Fire and Rescue, in that case, you have an employee who was concerned with some of the activities that her co-workers were engaged in. She went to her supervisors, multiple supervisors, and verbally complained about what was going on at the fire district. One of her supervisors said, document your concerns, and she did. She started writing down, she had a detailed journal and notes of all of the times that she felt her co-workers were wasting her time. Now, her notes were discovered by her co-workers, who turned them in to her supervisor, and she was reprimanded for that. The trial court, in that case, held that she was engaged in a protected activity. And this court reversed that, saying that no, she was keeping documentation. She was recording for the intention of later recording her concerns.
Well, this case obviously speaks to the importance of employees making a contemporary record, right? But is that required in every case to bring a whistleblower claim?
The statute requires a communication, and a communication is defined as a verbal or written report. So, the written report in this case would have been very helpful, yes.
But if it was just a verbal report, a oral report, the statute doesn't necessarily foreclose that, does it?
It does not. Mr. Dickinson was caught surreptitiously recording their conversation on the 3rd. And he doesn't, in his affidavit, state that at the May 3rd hearing, or meeting, that he reported his concerns. He did not just report. The following day, on May 4th, Mr. Dickinson had a conversation with the sheriff in an elevator. Mr. Dickinson had, at that time, the direct undivided attention of Sheriff Presser. And at that time, he didn't report the misconduct to the sheriff. At the May 3rd meeting, he had the direct and undivided attention of the sheriff. And he didn't report his suspicion of the violation of the law, either by the undersheriff or the deputy at that time.
But we don't know what he reported. We don't have the recording.
He testified in a deposition, Your Honor. And I'll read that into the record. This is a quote record, page 141. undermining of my authority as a principal sergeant. So at the time, Mr. Dinkley testified in his affidavit and at his deposition that he had discussed those issues with regard to Deputy Van Adder, Deputy Wynn, or Deputy Coley at the May 3rd meeting because they just didn't get to it. That's in his deposition testimony. On page 142, question, at the time, did you ask Under Sheriff Fields to step out of the office so that you could talk to Sheriff Webster about that he was going to have? Answer, no. And then...
Wait, just so I'm clear, though, doesn't the record support that the sheriff had just recently had a stroke and he wasn't dealing with personnel issues and assigned all personnel issues to the undersheriff?
The record reflects, through Mr. Dinkley's affidavit, that the sheriff had suffered a stroke and that all personnel matters were to be discussed first with the undersheriff. That did prevent him, and the police policy did prevent Mr. Dinkley from going to the sheriff, which he did. That's why he asked for the meeting of May 3rd. The policy allowed for the sheriff to delegate responsibilities of personnel issues to the undersheriff. But if the undersheriff wasn't meeting those responsibilities as Mr. Dickinson alleges or claims, then the policy allowed for him to go to the sheriff. And he did that. He requested the meeting with the sheriff and the sheriff on the 3rd. Mr. Dickinson claims that the policy unreasonably restricted his ability to document or record the waste. I would point to Idaho Code section where it states that Idaho 6.2104 subsection 4 states that an employer cannot implement rules or policies that unreasonably restrict an employee's ability to document suspected violations of law. The policy in question here didn't unreasonably restrict Mr. Dickinson's ability to report violations of law because it only prohibited surreptitious reports, secret reports that were unknown to the sheriff and the undersheriff. It did prevent Mr. Dickinson from submitting documentation at the meeting to the sheriff with regard to his suspicions. It didn't prevent him from telling the sheriff that he was recording. Had Mr. Dickinson honestly and transparently wanted to protect himself at that meeting, all he had to do was tell the sheriff that he was recording the meeting. When Sheriff Webster asked him, are you recording this conversation, all he had to do was say yes, and he would not have been in violation.
If he had started the meeting by saying, I'm recording this, wouldn't he be admitting to a policy violation from the outset? Wouldn't that have kind of been a non-starter?
Well, if he had stated that he was recording, it wouldn't have been a surreptitious recording. He wouldn't have been secretly recording the sheriff. If he had come in and said, Sheriff, I have some concerns that I would like to discuss with you, and I'm recording this conversation to document my report to you, he would have been in violation of the policy because he would have been surreptitiously recording at that point. And if the sheriff had told him, I don't want you recording this conversation, I don't want you recording the meeting, he could have taken notes. He could have asked somebody else to join him. There were a lot of other things he could have done to transparently and honestly protect himself, CYA, and he didn't do that. And it's important to note, too, that after the meeting of May 3rd, Mr. Dickinson did not take that recording and give it to anybody in the county with authority to hear his complaint. The trial court picked up on that. Mr. Dickinson had the opportunity to directly talk with the sheriff at the NACO meeting about his concerns and report him with his concerns of either the end of the sheriff or the deputy, and he didn't do that. But he also, after that meeting, did not take that recording for the purpose of reporting his concerns to anybody in the county with authority to initiate an investigation. And he didn't, after his suspension, he was suspended on May 9th, after his suspension, he could have immediately taken that recording as well and given it to somebody at the county with the authority to call up an investigation or to initiate.
Was it eventually brought out at the pre-termination hearing or the final appeal before the commissioners? Was the recording ever provided at the pre-termination hearing before the county commissioners or at the final appeal that he had before the county commission?
At the final appeal with the county commissioners, Mr. Dickinson was able to present evidence to the commissioners. I don't know, I wasn't at that hearing as to whether or not he actually gave the recording to the commissioners at that time. But he did present the information that he presented to the sheriff as pre-trial. So that was presented to the commissioners at the time of the pre-trial and appeal. I'd like to briefly touch on the third element of the whistleblower statute, which requires that Mr. Dickinson prove a causal connection between the adverse employment action and his termination. And this is probably the biggest hurdle for Mr. Dickinson to get over, both at the summary judgment level and at the trial court level. Under retaliatory discharge analysis, the focus on the third element is the motive for taking the adverse employment action, the motive that the county, the substantial motivating factor that the county had in placing Mr. Dickinson on suspended leave and then in that confirmation. And Mr. Dickinson hasn't presented any evidence to the trial court or to this court that there's that causal link. And while causation is generally an issue of fact for the jury, if there's no evidence of that causal link, and Mr. Dickinson has the burden of proof in this case, trying to issue case, then summary judgment can be granted.
Are there no reasonable inferences
that can be drawn?
We're at summary judgment stage here?
There can be reasonable inferences drawn. It's in fact most favorable to Mr. Dickinson. But again, the only evidence that he submitted at the summary judgment level is his affidavit. It contains their allegations that he tried for 2 years or for 6 months to report late, and that he was ignored. And those bare allegations alone can't defeat some of the issues.
But what about that document that he provided after he's placed on administrative leave, but before he's terminated?
Well, he has to show the causal connection between the suspension and him documenting or reporting that waste. You can't do that because it was after the fact.
But this isn't about the suspension. This case is about the termination, correct?
It's about both.
Right, but the suspension really becomes meaningless. It's really about the termination, right?
Correct. And the suspension was giving him a chance. He was suspended from his duties, and he was notified that the county was going to terminate.
Isn't it possible both things could be true? That he was fired for one reason, because he secretly recorded his bosses in a conversation against policy, and because he was going to say some things that they didn't want said. I mean, couldn't both be possibly true?
Well, the whistleblower statute requires a communication. It requires a predicate act. And he can't afford the protections of the whistleblower statute because he was going to because he was going to report. And that's what he suspended, and then he gives that report. That is...
Right, but at the time of discharge, they knew the kind of things that he was complaining about, right? And they still went ahead and fired him.
They knew he was complaining about the underlying actions of the undersheriff. That's the purpose of the meeting.
But they also knew about the specific allegations against certain deputies, didn't they?
The sheriff testified he didn't know of the specific allegations that Mr. Dickinson brought up.
Until the 6/26 hearing?
Correct.
And that just was, help me with the timeline then.
Sure.
What happened immediately before the 6/26 hearing?
Mr. Dickinson had a meeting on May 3rd, a conversation with the sheriff on May 4th. The discovery of the search history recording was between May 4th, May 5th, and May 8th. Mr. Dickinson was called into the sheriff's department on May 8th and was asked about the search history recording. And then he was placed on administrative leave on May 9th. On May 17th, he was given a formal notice of suspension. He was relieved of his duties and placed on administrative leave pending an investigation. They investigated into the matter. The sheriff's department found that he violated his policy and gave him a notice of termination.
Okay, what's the date on that?
Of the notice of termination?
Yes.
I believe it was May 17th. But I don't have the time.
So So the 626 hearing then, that was a court proceeding?
That was a, no, the 626 meeting, and we keep saying hearing, but it was actually, it was a main hearing, a pre-termination hearing where the sheriff and Mr. Jacobson and the city clerk were present. And that was when Mr. Jacobson gave the document to the sheriff.
I'm only calling it a hearing because the document says discussed at 6-26-19 hearing.
I believe that the notice of termination gave him a right to a pre-termination hearing and a main hearing.
Okay.
And so that's what I believe you know.
That was very helpful. Thank you.
Yes. And then after he submitted that report, the sheriff initiated an investigation into the conduct that he had complained of. And that conduct was later found to be either already addressed, unfounded, unsupported by evidence, and then he was given his notice of termination. After that, he was again given an opportunity with the county commissioners in an appeal hearing to appeal his termination, and the county commissioners held his termination. I'm almost out of time, so the court doesn't have any other questions.
Here's your honor. Very well, thank you. Madam Clerk, how much time does the appellant have remaining?
9 minutes.
Sir?
The key to where we're at at this point is my client's statement under oath regarding the May the 3rd or 5th meeting. We didn't get that far. The sheriff didn't want to hear it. It meaning the problems in the department. So why wasn't there all these reportings on the recording? Because the sheriff didn't want to hear it. That's clear in the evidence.
I need to ask you, counsel, why don't we have the recording from your perspective?
It was not wrong, and there was only what the sheriff and the undersheriff have always agreed to, and that's the undersheriff hears personnel issues. So when my client said, why didn't you report it to the sheriff when you were recording, his answer was, we didn't get that far. There wasn't the opportunity to report. The sheriff wouldn't hear it. The first time the sheriff would hear it was after my client was told, you're going to be fired. We'll give you your day in a hearing, June 26th. Tell me what you know on June 26th. That was the first time the sheriff would hear the problems in his own department. In the briefing, we disputed the sheriff's characterization of the findings. We say that the majority of the findings were that there were problems. Didn't say they were dealt with. So, but that is a time that stops as far as my client's ability and, well, it's just ability to report. And that's the June 26th meeting. And he submitted written statements. That was the first, frankly, only time he was able to talk with the sheriff. It's undisputed that he tried to talk to and, in fact, did report things to the undersheriff. That they have no evidence contrary to my client's affidavit where he said, I tried. That certainly meets the statute. Now, I'm going to fall back on, this is a small sheriff's department. There are, when you put something in writing, it takes it to a whole new level. Especially things that are involved with malfeasance of deputies. I would imagine if my client could go back in time and make more official statements to the undersheriff, he probably would. But he already documented and been told he don't get to report anymore.
Well, let me push back on that a little bit. This was a law enforcement officer. Part of their job is to make written records. I've read tons of them in my career. That's what they do. And I'm just wondering why it just seems out of character for an officer, if he saw something illegal within his own department, not to make a written note about it somewhere. It just seems completely, it's hard to believe, to be honest.
Well, Your Honor, the issue, and I believe it was Chief Justice Bevin who said, well, where's the prosecutor in all this? They knew. They were doing investigation. They were looking into it. And, well, I can evidence that the finding that they had already been dealt with, the issues that my client had reported had already been dealt with, show that they have been reported. My client agree with the way they were dealt with? I don't know. That's
shouldn't the argument be that the bigger Brady concern here isn't that your client lied about recording something, but that there were officers engaged in all kinds of constitutional behavior that wasn't being made public? If that comes out, that the certain officer slashed tires, for example, I imagine that would affect the credibility of that officer in future proceedings.
And my client, that's exactly what he was trying to do, Your Honor. He was trying to, through the chain of command, document and inform. And instead he was ridiculed. So we would ask at this point to look at this case with the lens of Rule 56. My client has made statements. He's made sworn statements. Those statements, specifically about the reporting, but also about why and how we reported in conjunction with subsection 4. This case is what a jury needs to hear. It's certainly the balance or the battle between the facts. This should have been heard by a jury.
Mr. Pierce, I wholeheartedly agree to the extent that the facts are made known to this court on appeal. But I've reviewed your statement of disputed facts just now again, pages 4 through 6 of your opening brief, and there's not one citation to the record. And it's not incumbent on us to dig through the record, as we've obviously done, as you can tell from the questions today, and find all these potential issues of fact out there, when you don't even cite to them by line and verse in your opening brief. That's required by our rules. It wasn't done here. Do you have an explanation of why we should dig through this record, find all these attempts? I even just searched for "I tried to" in your opening brief. It's not in there. So tell us why we should ignore the rule and just say, fine, we'll go dig up all these questions of fact and send this back because the trial judge got it wrong. I agree. Questions of fact shouldn't be allowed to pass, but you have to point them to us. It's your burden on people. What do we do then?
If I could go back in time, I would not use the footnote taken verbatim from plaintiff's responsive brief in the motion for summary judgment. And that was very poor drafting on my part, Chief Justice Devin. But that was where the citations, I thought they were. And so I was wrongfully trying to save, to make it more clear as to my disputed facts. That was very poor craftsmanship on my part. And I can only apologize for having tried to do it that way. I should have put your citation in there. If there's no further questions, I would submit.
Very well. If there are no other questions, sir, thank you to you and also to Ms. Fager, thank you. The matter is now under advisement. We're under decision accordingly. We'll be in recess approximately 10 minutes. Thank you.
All rise.